In our reading, we're going to come across some very angry people. And as I read it, I want you to notice what you think is appropriate about that anger or inappropriate, and start to think about what your experience and relationship has been with anger in your own life. This is 1 Samuel chapter 24. After Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told, "David is in the desert of En-Gedi." So Saul took 3,000 able young men from all Israel and set out to look for David and his men near the crags of the wild goats. He came to the sheep pens along the way. A cave was there, and Saul went in to relieve himself. David and his men were far back in the cave. The men said, "This is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, 'I will give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish.'" Then David crept up unnoticed and cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Afterward, David was conscience-stricken for having cut off a corner of his robe. He said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lay my hand on him, for he is the anointed of the Lord." With these words, David sharply rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul. And Saul left the cave and went his way. Then David went out of the cave and called out to Saul, "My lord, the king." When Saul looked behind him, David bowed down and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. He said to Saul, "Why do you listen when men say David is bent on harming you? This day you've seen with your own eyes how the Lord delivered you into my hands in the cave. Some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, 'I will not lay my hand on my Lord, because he is the Lord's anointed.' See, my father, look at this piece of your robe in my hand. I cut off the corner of your robe, but did not kill you. See that there is nothing in my hand to indicate that I'm guilty of wrongdoing or rebellion. I have not wronged you, but you are hunting me down to take my life. May the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me, but my hand will not touch you. As the old saying goes, from evildoers come evil deeds, so my hand will not touch you. Against whom has the king of Israel come out? Who are you pursuing? A dead dog? A flea? May the Lord be our judge and decide between us. May he consider my cause and uphold it. May he vindicate me by delivering me from your hand." When David finished saying this, Saul asked, "Is that your voice, David, my son?" And he wept aloud. "You are more righteous than I," he said. "You've treated me well, but I've treated you badly. You've just now told me about the good you did to me. The Lord delivered me into your hands, but you did not kill me. When a man finds his enemy, does he let him get away unharmed? May the Lord reward you well for the way you treated me today. I know that you will surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hands. Now swear to me by the Lord that you will not kill off my descendants or wipe out my name from my father's family." So David gave his oath to Saul. Then Saul returned home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. This is God's word. And in case you're wondering, no, this is not the beginning of a new friendship between David and Saul. Saul had said things like this before, and he would say them again, and it never really seemed to last. And so you really just have to wonder, why is Saul so angry? You can go back in the narrative and see where it began, where it really took a turn, and it was right after David had killed Goliath in that spectacular victory. Saul gave David a high rank in the army, which made everyone in the army happy because they loved him. And the people loved him too. And every time he was sent out on a mission, he came back successful because the Lord was with him. And he was beginning to get so popular that the women actually made up a song about him and they would dance to it. And it goes like this: "Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands." And if you're wondering how Saul felt about that song, it says, Saul was very angry. This refrain displeased him greatly. And so the simple answer, of course, to why is Saul so angry is jealousy, right? Well, I don't actually think, though, that classifying the anger really explains it. It doesn't really help us get to the bottom of it, because what is anger? At its root, it's not defined by the intensity of the emotion or the surge of adrenaline or how it's expressed, whether it's bitterness or sarcasm or even violence. No matter where it comes from or how it's expressed, anger is actually pretty simple. Anger, at its core, it says, I'm against that. David Paulinson is an author and a counselor who puts it this way. Anger is active displeasure towards something that's important enough to care about. And he breaks it down a little bit further than that, that no matter what type of anger, it always has three main components. First, I identify something that I perceive as wrong. Second, I take a stance of disapproval and I feel displeasure about it. And then third, in some way, I'm moved to action. And at the very least, there's potential that I'm going to say or do something about it. Now, the reason that it's helpful to break it down like that isn't because you didn't understand what anger was, but when you break it down into its component parts, you can get straight to proposing solutions. So first, you can remove or you can correct the wrong. Second, you could change your judgment about it. Or third, you could distance yourself from it, whether that means emotionally or physically, until you get to the point where you just don't care about it anymore. Now, that actually holds true, by the way, whether you were right or wrong in your initial judgment. So in other words, anger as an emotion, it's not good or bad in itself. It's a reaction, and actually a very natural one, to whatever threatens to hurt or damage or destroy something that you cherish. So what a person gets angry about depends on what it is that they cherish. So you see that anger is actually very closely connected with love. Because you're not going to get angry about something getting destroyed or threatened if you don't really care about it, right? So back to the original question, why was Saul so angry? Well, it has everything to do with what Saul loved. And it seems like what Saul loved more than anything else was being number one, being in control, being in charge, being important. And when God told him that he was rejected as king, because of his unfaithfulness and his wickedness, that his son Jonathan was not going to take over the throne after him, that would be David instead. Saul was furious. And in the five chapters between what we read last week and what we see this week, we can see what anger is doing to Saul. He's unraveling. He's being completely undone by his jealousy. And he actually did everything at his disposal to try to get rid of David. It started by just sending him on really dangerous missions, hoping that he wouldn't come back. But because God was with him, God was protecting him, God was giving him success, he always came back having accomplished the mission, which only served to increase his glory and increase his renown and his popularity, which in turn made Saul just that much more jealous. Now, Saul's next move was to tell his son, Jonathan, to kill David himself. Jonathan, of course, refused because by this time, Jonathan and David were best friends. Also, Saul's daughter, Michal, fell in love with David, and Saul was kind of stuck because he had promised the hand of his daughter to whoever could defeat Goliath, so they ended up getting married. And now Saul is just insanely upset and paranoid because it seems like even his own family prefers David to him. And his rage got to a point that it wasn't even tethered to reality anymore. And anyone who had even the slightest hint of disloyalty, he made his enemy. And the most shocking example of that is what Saul did to a town called Nob. Nob was the place where the tabernacle had been set up. And at one point when David was fleeing from Saul, he had no backup, he had no supplies, he had no weapons. So he goes to Nob, he goes to the tabernacle, he goes to the high priest, who gives him some bread, and he gives him the sword of Goliath that David had taken off of Goliath's body, because David actually lied to him and told him that he was on a secret mission from Saul. And of course, when Saul heard about this, that the priest had helped him and then let him go, he massacred the entire town. 85 priests, along with every man, woman, child, infant. He didn't even leave the animals alive. Anger consumed him. He was obsessed. And so for years, David was on the run, but always narrowly escaping Saul at every turn because he was under God's protection, which means, of course, there was never a chance There was never even the slightest chance that Saul was going to get David. God had already promised that David would be the next king. It was just a matter of time. And what we read today was that David actually had a chance to fast forward through all of this, this period of hardship. He had the chance to end his suffering and end his exile and end Saul. He was hiding for his life in a cave, and who should show up right in front of him but his tormentor, his persecutor, oblivious to the danger he was in. What had probably happened is Saul had taken off his robe and set it aside so that it wouldn't get dirty while he squatted down and took care of his business. And then David was able to, as his men said, deal with Saul as he wished. And I want you to just think of all the reasons that David had to go through with it. Saul had driven him from his home and his family. He had sentenced him to live as a fugitive. And we'll actually find out in the next chapter that in David's absence, Saul had taken Michal, his daughter, and David's wife, and given her in marriage to another man. That could be a powerful motivator, right? One stroke of the blade, David could have his old life back. And didn't Saul also deserve it because of what he did to Nob, all those people he killed? That cruelty had to be answered. Not to mention all the people you could potentially be saving from Saul's next rampage. And you know, you could also make a case on the basis of what's best for the kingdom. Saul doesn't seem capable or even interested in ruling at this point, does he? He's out there with thousands of soldiers chasing after one man on the basis of a personal vendetta. And David made that point himself when he confronted Saul. He called himself a dead dog, a flea. What he's saying is this is a total waste of time and resources to be doing this rather than seeing to the needs and defending the borders of Israel. And now, on top of all of that, with Saul out of the way, David had already been anointed. So if he had killed Saul, he would have been the next king. So David actually had a whole lot of reasons to say about Saul, about this whole situation, I'm against that. So why didn't he? Why didn't he kill Saul when he had the chance? And he explained it pretty clearly. He said it's because it wasn't God's plan. God had chosen Saul. God had put Saul on the throne, and no one but God had the right to remove him. And David here shows us something really important about anger. See, because it's not that he wasn't angry. He was. You can see it in the way that he dealt with his men, the ones who tried to convince him that it was God's will to kill Saul. And then afterwards, it seems to me at least, that they even thought to do it themselves. Verse 7 said, with these words, David sharply rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul. Now, sharply rebuked is actually a pretty gentle way of translating it. The Hebrew literally says, David tore apart his men with words. He was angry. And his anger shows what David was for and what he was against. Yeah, he was against what Saul was doing, but he cherished the Lord. Well, there's something about it that seems counterintuitive, though, right? Because isn't God against Saul? Isn't God against tyranny and abuse of power and self-serving rulers and the slaughter of innocent people? Well, yes, he is. He absolutely is, which is why God gets to deal with those people the way that God chooses to deal with them. And that was David's confession in verse 12. He said, may the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs you have done to me, but my hand will not touch you. So now we've got a new thing to deal with. How do we deal with the fact that we have a God of vengeance? Isn't he supposed to be a God of love? Now, there are actually two different ways that people tend to misunderstand God. And one is to see him as nothing but an angry God who lives for vengeance, who gives laws that are impossible to keep and judges against a standard that we can never live up to. And he's just waiting around for us to really mess up so he can come down hard and destroy us. Now, the other dangerous misunderstanding is kind of the opposite. The idea that God is closer to a kindly old grandfather who smiles and chuckles about the naughty things we do because, you know, kids will be kids. And then he scoops us up onto his lap and forgets every bad thing we've ever done. You want to know what God is really like? He's a God of love and a God of anger. Because no one, not even God, can be one without the other, because it's a contradiction. You can't say that you've got a God of love if he never gets angry, because you know what anger really is? You remember? It's what happens when something you love is being threatened. And what in particular you are angry about shows you, like nothing else, what you love the most. The Bible actually says, it's in Ephesians 2, that we were by nature deserving of wrath. That means that every single one of us comes into this world under a threat, because our natural state ever since the fall into sin is to be against God. But because he's a God of infinite and unfailing love, he was angry. Angry about the sin that threatens, that corrupts, that destroys what he loves. And so he did something about it. He sent his son Jesus, the son of David. You know that Jesus actually got angry sometimes? You know what really set Jesus off? Religious people who used God's laws to oppress and to harm. He got angry when his disciples tried to keep little children away from him. He got angry when people turned the temple into a market and took away people's opportunity to worship. You know what? More than anything else, Jesus got angry at death. What's the common thread through all of those things? Jesus got angry about anything that would keep the ones he loved away from him. And so, just like his ancestor David, he opposed that evil. He was against it. But he gave it to his father to avenge the wrongs. But unlike David, better than David, Jesus allowed himself to be caught by his enemies, to be slaughtered by his enemies, and to be treated like an enemy of God the Father, who gathered up all that evil and all that wrong, everything that he was against, he gathered up to one single spot, his son Jesus, and then he destroyed it on the cross. It's his anger that shows what he loves the most. It shows what he treasures, and that's you and me. And then Jesus rose to prove that now for us there is no more anger. There is no more wrath. There's no more condemnation, not for those who are in him. And he also rose to point us to a time when there will be no more anger. Remember the beginning, I mentioned what anger is, and it begins with identifying something that you perceive as wrong. And when Jesus comes back to finally deal with everything that he's against, conflict and oppression and even death, he's going to take us to heaven when there will be nothing left to be angry about. There will be nothing wrong. There will be nothing that threatens to destroy us, nothing left that could ever take us away from him. And so, okay, what does any of this have to do with Christian education? Well, this account actually isn't in the Bible so that we can take comfort in how great David was. It's not in the Bible so we can compare ourselves to him and take increasing levels of comfort as we see that we can sort of be like him. I want to show you one of the things that God did to prepare David for this day. And we actually read about it. It was at the end of our first reading. While David was at Horesh in the desert of Ziph, he learned that Saul had come out to take his life. And Saul's son, Jonathan, went to David at Horesh and helped him find strength in God. "Don't be afraid," he said. "My father Saul will not lay a hand on you. You will be king over Israel, and I will be second to you. Even my father knows, Saul knows this." Saul couldn't find David out in the wilderness. And the text doesn't actually tell us how Jonathan was able to find him or how difficult the journey was or what it cost him. But it does tell us why he went, to help David find strength in God. See, he didn't come to give good advice. He didn't come to tell him everything was going to be okay. And it's actually put really beautifully in the Hebrew. It literally says that Jonathan made strong his hand in God. So in other words, it's as if he put David's hand into God's hand. This isn't a prophecy. This isn't some new revelation from God, these words from Jonathan. And we know it because Jonathan was actually partly wrong. He was right that Saul wouldn't lay a hand on David. He was right that David would be king over Israel, but he was wrong about becoming second in command because Jonathan died in battle before that could ever happen. So what's so encouraging about that? Now, it must have been nice for David to see his friend again, but clearly that's not the sort of encouragement that lasts. What did Jonathan actually do? Nothing more or less than what we can do. He repeated God's promises, and he applied them like a soothing medicine directly to David's anxiety and David's fears and David's weakness, so that when the time came that David was tempted to take a shortcut to end his suffering, tempted to willfully misinterpret circumstances to suit and justify what he really wanted to do, to let his feelings guide his actions, David put all his trust in God, in God's will, and in God's timing. God sent Jonathan not just as a friend, but as a spiritual mentor. Now imagine in your growth groups this week, or your morning circles, or wherever it is that you gather with other Christians, and people are going around the circle and they're making their prayer requests, and one person says, I'd like God to help me be more patient. And someone else says, my sister's in the hospital, I'm praying for healing. Someone else facing an uncertain work situation says, I'm asking God for guidance and for peace. And then it comes to the last person who says, God, make me angry. God, fill my prayers with more fury and more rage. Have you ever prayed like that? Not for a selfish anger or a toxic anger or a self-righteous anger or anything that's going to tempt us to take shortcuts towards our own twisted version of justice. That's the sort of anger that we beg God to guard our hearts against. But what we don't want is to go so far to the other end that we aren't angry at all. Because not being angry can actually be a problem. It might mean that we're not caring enough about the things that God cares about. What we're asking for is a fierce, protective anger that mirrors God's holy and righteous anger over anything that threatens not what we love, but what he loves. And then we align our loves to him. And yet we also are giving up our right to vengeance to God and trusting in his wisdom and his timing, which ironically leads to a greater peace than anything this world can give, because we know that when God says that he's going to do something, it will be done. And this is our charge. And this is true for all of us, but we're saying it especially today to the educators among us who have committed themselves to doing the work of discipling children here at St. Marcus. Learn to cherish what God cherishes. Learn to be against what God is against, even when you find it in your own heart. And take the hands of the children that you serve and place them in God's hands. Help them find strength in God by repeating his promises to them. God bless you for the ways that you're doing that, the ways that you're preparing them for the battles to come and leading them to Jesus, who loves them even more than you do. Jesus paid an unspeakable cost for them so that nothing could ever keep them from him. Let's pray. Dear Father, you so loved the world that you gave your Son to be the object of your anger, of your wrath, and to give us your peace and set us free. Continue to give us grace to really understand what Jesus did and to give us strength for our own battles, and that it would change us and give us hope and empower us to lead more people to you. In Jesus' name, amen.
This podcast is a production of St. Marcus Ministries. For similar content, subscribe to our St. Marcus Church YouTube channel or follow us on Facebook. If you're seeking ways to grow, serve, or give, download the Church Center app and add St. Marcus as your church. There, you can submit private prayer requests, receive weekly news updates, and more. If you enjoy these messages, please subscribe and share with a friend. Thank you for listening, and God bless.